Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
I've got this feeling.
It relevant.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
I've got this feeling.
You may be saying to yourself, it sounds a little different this morning on the Patrick Madrid Show. Why? What's different about it? The music is different. And let's play this a little bit longer, Cyrus. Okay. The reason for that song instead of the standard Patrick Madrid Show theme music is because today very well may be the day. We don't know for sure, but it's looking as though today is the day that the Supreme Court is going to make its ruling on the Dobbs case official, the one that you've been hearing about and people talking a lot about over the last, well, especially over the last month or two, since somebody working at the Supreme Court, we don't really know who yet, but somebody leaked the draft of the opinion by Justice Alito, 99 pages long, and in effect will overturn Roe versus Wade. So this may be the day when that is announced. So hence the music. If you like that song, it's from America. And we'll be keeping an eye on this news. It looks as though the announcements are going to begin to be made public in about 25 minutes and 42 seconds. But who's counting? So we're keeping an eye on this. And as this news develops today, I'm going to share it with you. Whatever may happen, I'll share it with you and keep tuned here at Relevant Radio for continuing coverage throughout the day. And in the meantime, it's a regular show, as per usual. You can call and be on the air with me. I'd love to talk to you. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I've got lots to share with you today. And if you've got something to share with me, give me a call. Let's start off with Deb in Naples, Florida. Good morning, Deb, and welcome.
Well, thank you. my husband and I, we live in Florida, and we drive up north in the summer. Stay with our daughter for about 6 weeks. Help her out. She's got a house. Uh-huh. And we drove up there, she told us a couple of hours before we got there that her boyfriend is living with her. And, we just don't want to be a part of that. And we told her that we could not stay with her. And we left. Mm-hmm. And we came back home. And because it's sinful. And I know that if we live with her, it's being complicit to what she's doing. My question is that this boyfriend, he's in the reserves. And he's going to be deployed in about 10 days. So he won't be there. Mm-hmm. But all of his stuff is there. I mean, he has moved in. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid that she's going to come back and say, well, he's gone now, you know, come on up. Mm-hmm. And is that still being complicit if we stay with her?
I don't think so. I completely understand your concern. So I want to, you know, empathize with you for what you're going through. And your instincts are correct that you love your daughter and you want to support her however you can. But you want to be careful that you don't, in so doing, also give her the misimpression that you somehow approve of this new lifestyle arrangement. So I understand where you're coming from. But if you look at the situation through these three lenses, I think you can come to the same conclusion that I just came to, which is I don't think you would be doing anything immoral or complicit. And that would be, number one, consider the object of the act itself. What is it that you are doing, or what is it you would be doing? You'd be living with your daughter. And just her, in this case. Is there anything intrinsically immoral? Is there anything problematic in a moral sense about living under the same roof with your family member, especially one as close as your daughter? Well, no, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that. There's nothing about that that would be a red flag. The second lens would be, what is your intention? Are you intending to do something that would give approval to her living with her boyfriend, which she wouldn't be doing at that time? No. You've already told her that you don't agree with it, and you went so far as to say that we're not going to visit if he's there living with you. So there's nothing in your intention that seems to me to be problematic. You're not trying to do something that is wrong. Furthermore, the circumstances also seem to me to be a green light. That's the third lens to look at it through. What are the circumstances? Well, number one, he's gone. This is your daughter. She lives in this house. It's natural for moms and dads to visit their grown children and vice versa. So here you are visiting with her, staying under her roof, eating meals together, and all the other family things that you might do. The circumstances are completely benign. So personally, if we look at it through those three lenses, I don't see anything about this scenario that would suggest a problem. So if you're asking for my take on it, that's my take on it. I don't see anything about this that would put you in any difficult moral situation.
Good. We have to go back up there because we have like a family reunion going on that we're putting on. And because we are going back up there, that's the direction I needed. I need to know if she still wants us to visit her, if we could stay with her, and if not, we would find somewhere else to stay.
Has she said yet whether or not she wants you to stay with her after you left so abruptly last time? Did that damage the relationship at all?
Well, I'm pretty sure it dampened her relationship with us. But she hasn't talked to me since. It just happened 5 days ago. Okay. But I think that she'll be calling once he's gone. I think she's going to call.
Yeah, and sure she needs you, and you need her. And, you know, what a terrible thing it would be if this took a wrong turn and it put a freeze on your relationship with your daughter for who knows how long. I think, based upon what you're saying, that this is a great opportunity because you'll be alone with her. And you and your husband can reestablish some of the rapport that may have been lost. And it's as they call it, a teachable moment in that you'll have an opportunity to like really talk to her without the guy being there. And I see a lot of upside in this situation. You know, if I were in that position, Deb, I would be trying to make it work so that you could stay with her.
Good, because we're not trying to freeze her out of our relationship. Mm-hmm. We feel that even if he was still living there, we still want to see her. Now, we might not go over there for dinner, but they
is
could
he
come,
a cad?
You know.
I mean, is there any redeeming quality about him? Is it possible he could be a good husband at some point in the future, or do you know?
I don't know. I don't know that much about him. I know he's. I don't think he grew up with any kind of religion. Mm-hmm. But of course, we're Catholic. We raised them, you know, my daughter Catholic. He doesn't have any religious background or, religion in his life. I know that he is divorced. He has a daughter,
a 6-year-old. A lot
daughter.
Of red flags here.
Yeah.
If she were my daughter, Deb, I would say to her as gently as I could, you know, I understand it's kind of fun and, you know, you enjoy the romance and whatever else is involved, but he's using you. He's just using you. He's using you for his own pleasure. And look, he's already left one woman and there's no reason to think that he won't leave you when the time comes and somebody prettier or nicer or wealthier or whatever comes along. Why would you want to let yourself be used like that? You know, why spend the best years of your life in terms of your availability to get married with somebody who's not even willing to commit to you by getting married to you? He just wants to live with you and enjoy you. Why would you want to do that? And wouldn't it be a whole lot better if you were looking for the right person that you could commit your whole life to? Now, I'm sure these are things you and your husband already know because you're living that in your own marriage, obviously. Maybe, and I'll leave you with this final thought, Deb, maybe get a copy of Steve Wood's book, The ABCs of Finding a Good Husband. And when you go there, give it to her maybe sign a nice handwritten note in the front. And that way, after you're gone from your visit, that will remain. And even if she doesn't read it right away, I wouldn't be surprised if she starts thumbing through this book out of curiosity to see what kind of advice. And it is very good advice, by the way, the ABCs of finding a good husband. And Steve Wood will let her know that this situation where she's just available to be used by this guy until something better comes along is not in her best interests. And it may well be too, Deb, that you, the message that you and your husband have been trying to impart to her may be getting blocked in some way because of family weirdness and family relationships. Every family has it. And often our own family members are the last ones who will listen to what you or I might have to say. So when a third person who's not a family member, you know, not anybody who's got any baggage with her, is saying something, it might get her attention in a different way. So try that out. It's called The ABCs of Finding a Good Husband. That's for the ladies. Now for the men, The ABCs of Finding a Good Wife. Two different books with two different messages, but the same idea. Thanks, Deb. 888-914-9149. I want to share with you a communique that was issued yesterday, I believe. This is from the Diocese of Stockton in Central Valley, California. It's under the heading Urgent Memo, All Clergy, Parish Staff, Religious and Pastoral Center Staff. The diocese spoke with the Department of Homeland Security agent Jesse Rangel yesterday, where we were made privy to the latest nationwide intelligence reports regarding the Dobbs decision. Now, I'll pause it. That's the decision I referred to earlier that is very, very likely going to be issued definitively today. And if the draft of the majority opinion that was written by Justice Alito, if in fact that is the final decision, then it will in effect overturn Roe versus Wade, the 1973 ruling by the Supreme Court that a woman has a right to privacy. And under this so-called right to privacy, that therefore she can have an abortion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We've been living with that since 1973. So, referring to the Dobbs decision here, the Diocese of Stockton says, a manifesto has been found by federal law enforcement officials of an extremist group calling for a night of rage, beginning at 8 p.m., the night of the Supreme Court decision being handed down, which may well be today. The group is essentially calling for extreme violence against Catholic churches and pregnancy centers. Agent Rangel stated that large groups with cells nationwide have already been discovered casing parishes, including here in California. Bishop Cota and the Office of Media and Communications are now issuing a critical notice to all clergy, parishes, and pastoral center staff to meet immediately with your team and develop a plan should you see or hear anything suspicious. Make sure you have ushers and or security available during your services. I think that means Mass. And perhaps identify who among your volunteers and parishioners are law enforcement. Suspicious activity would include someone asking out-of-place questions, like, what's the largest Mass time? Are the doors always open? Do you have security? Or looking around church property, as well as protesters and general disturbances. If you see or encounter any suspicious activity, please call the parish office. Thank you. Now, this is issued, or apparently was printed, in the bulletin of St. Patrick's Church in Ripon, California. But it emanates from the diocese itself. That's the Diocese of Stockton. Now, we haven't really discussed much on this program, at least, in terms of the threats that have been made. I've talked about it a little bit here and there, but we want to keep the focus on the positive as much as possible. However, there have been the sort of continued calls, especially on social media, for what they're calling, as it says in that memo, a night of rage, where they're asking for people to rise up and do acts of violence and vandalism and hopefully nothing beyond that, but that's what they are calling for. Now, there is a document here, and it is available from the Anarchist Library. And it is, in essence, it's the manifesto that has been publicized by this group. And I think you should be aware of it, because this is like a plan. This is their plan that they're asking people who feel like they do to participate in and do certain things. So what I'm going to do is, because it's a little bit longer than what I have time to be able to share at the moment, I'm going to share that with you when we come back from this break, which we're going to take in a few minutes. So that's coming. I welcome your phone calls. Let's stay prayerful. Let's stay focused. Let's stay peaceful, obviously. Let's stay humble. And if today indeed is the day that Roe versus Wade is effectively overturned, if the Dobbs decision comes out as we expect that it will, it is a momentous day, no doubt about it. And think of all the hundreds of millions of memoraries that have been prayed over the last several years for the end to abortion. Now, this would not signal the end of abortion, far from it, because it would revert to the states. But it is still a very, potentially a very momentous day, and we'll see how things go. And this is all the more reason why you need to stay tuned to Relevant Radio throughout the day. This is an historic occasion. Big, capital H, historic. So we want to be focused and prayerful and humble and just see how things unfold, and we will keep you fully updated as things go along. Let's go, why don't we do this? Why don't we break now? And then when we return, then we will get into this manifesto about this so-called Night of Rage. And I want you to be aware of what they're asking people to do. Let's hope that they don't do it. Let's keep things calm and peaceful. I'll be right back with more right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
I've got this feeling that today's the day. I've got this feeling today's the day.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
I've got this feeling.
Today could be the day, according to the Supreme Court of the United States blog, SCOTUSblog.com. In 7 minutes and 9 seconds, the Supreme Court will begin releasing opinions on various decisions, including the Dobbs decision, which, as I said, is the one that if it is handed down in the form that Justice Alito wrote it, the draft opinion of which was leaked by somebody on the Supreme Court staff. We don't know yet who, or hasn't been told to us yet, who did that. Maybe we'll never know. But I think that was a preemptive strike to try to rally the forces against it. But in any case, that very likely is going to come out today. So we're going to keep you informed. You don't want to miss all the developments surrounding this story. It is an historic day, and I want you to be fully informed. So stick with us here at Relevant Radio. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Dave, first of all, in Lakeville, Minnesota. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Patrick. How are you?
I am well,
and
thank you.
A couple questions for you today. I was curious if you ever need to clean up picks.
Well, I mean, if you're the parish priest and after time goes by and the pyx is being handled by various people and the Holy Eucharist is being placed in it, taken out of it, placed in it, taken out of it for bringing to the sick, sure, I would think as a matter of course, every so often you would want to clean it like you would any other sacred vessel. But it would depend, it seems, on how often it's used. So if it's being used a lot, I would clean it on a regular basis. Why do you ask? Are you extraordinary minister of Holy Communion for the sick?
No, I bring communion to my mother-in-law at home.
I see.
And that's been every week now for 3 years, and we've been using the same picks. And I watch the priest do all the detailing as far as getting all the communion pens and ciboria and all that stuff cleaned.
Yeah, I would say that would be something he should do, or the deacon at the parish. So rather than you undertaking that as a layman, just bring it to the parish and have the priest do that. And then when he's done with it, give it back to you, I would say.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I had a second question. I was at a religious service, a Lutheran religious service, years ago for a friend of mine. One of their children was having a milestone in the Lutheran faith, and I don't remember exactly what that was. Mm-hmm. But they did the creed. They said, "We believe in the Holy Spirit and the Holy Catholic Church."
Right.
And I just kind of, I thought, well, why did they say that?
Well, they mean by that word Catholic something different than you and I mean. I'm assuming you're a Catholic from what you said a minute ago. So we understand that the creed, as it was composed by the Constantinopolitan Nicene fathers, at those two creeds especially, they understood it to mean the Catholic Church with a capital C, the church established by Jesus Christ, with all of the particulars and distinctives of that church, including the authority to formally define dogma and explain or convey that dogma in the form of a creed. But Lutherans and others, other non-Catholics who will recite the creed, I appreciate the fact that they don't try to alter it and change the wording, so they say the word that's there, but they mean by that Catholic, not the Catholic Church. They mean small c, kind of the quote-unquote universal church, this sort of ambiguous idea of the church as a whole, believers everywhere. They don't have a proper ecclesiology, meaning they don't understand the true ecclesiology behind that word Catholic and what it means. So when they say the creed, they're not saying it the way you're saying it. They're saying the same word, but they don't mean the Catholic Church. They would say that's not what it means. It means the universal church. It means the sort of mere Christianity, if you want to use C.S. Lewis's term. That's why they say it, but they don't feel bothered by it because they're saying something in their mind different from what you and I are as Catholics.
I see. I remember that when it was up on the screen that Catholic was not capitalized.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And just to touch on one thing from yesterday back on, you're talking about machines taking over. I had one particular Twilight Zone episode. Anybody who's a fan of it would remember from Agnes with Love.
I'll have to look it up. I am a Twilight Zone aficionado, but off the top of my head, I'm not remembering that one. But I'll look it up. Thank you, Dan, or Dave, excuse me. I appreciate that, and look forward to our next conversation. Let's go now to Miranda in Alexandria, Minnesota. Hi, Miranda.
Hello, Patrick. Hey, I have two questions. The first one was about the Book of Apocrypha or whatever. I don't know much about them. Are they legitimate? Yes or no? And then
Let's start there. Okay, before you give me the second one, because I will forget by the time you get to the third one.
No worries.
So the apocryphal books that's a term that is generally used by Protestants. It's not really a Catholic term. It's not a bad term. It just has connotations that Catholics would not mean by using the term. So in the Protestant world, the Apocrypha are what they regard to be these additional books that the Catholic Church has jammed into the Bible that don't belong there because they're not inspired, and they have this idea that the early church as a whole didn't accept them, and it's got goofy stuff in there like about purgatory in Second Maccabees chapter 12 and other things that they object to. So for them, the word Apocrypha is sort of a pejorative term. But in reality, the more common term, or the term you certainly will hear Catholics use, is deuterocanonical. And that simply means, from the Greek, it means the second canon. It doesn't mean second in terms of importance. It means that these books, and we're talking here about Baruch and Judith and 1st and 2nd Maccabees, etc., these books, seven of them in particular, in the Old Testament, were not immediately and not universally, at least right away, recognized as canonical, as scriptural. And there's a whole background to this story. It's an amazing and very interesting story about what happened. And a good book, if you're interested in reading kind of like a very detailed account of this, it would be Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger by, well, his name's, his name is right there on the tip of my brain. I can't say it, but I won't think about it, and then his name will come to me. So Why Catholic Bibles Are Bigger is the name of the book, and it gives you an historical background of those books that the Protestant world refers to as the Apocrypha. Now, an interesting thing about them is that they are in the Catholic Bible. There are some that are categorized as generally as apocryphal books or deuterocanonical books that are not in the Catholic Bible, but those particular seven are. And what's interesting is that they were included, believe it or not, in the King James Bible, which was the premier English language Bible from the time of the Protestant Reformation, 1611, you know, after the Reformation itself, but early on. It was authorized by King James himself in 1611, and it had those seven books in an appendix. It wasn't in the Old Testament section, but there was an appendix because even those Protestants and those scholars recognized that there was importance and value to these seven books. And so it was there. Now, it remained in the King James authorized version, it being this group of texts, until more or less the middle of the 19th century. So we're talking right around the time of the Civil War, give or take a few years, right in that area. I have to go back and look at it. When the British Bible Society, it decided to remove them because it was too popish, too papist, too Catholic, and they didn't want them in there. So they removed them, and from that point forward, the King James Bible no longer had those deuterocanonical books that had been called the apocryphal books. So they're entirely sound. They're entirely, you know, inspired and good for you to read and know, and many interesting things are there. In fact, the Jewish celebration of Hanukkah, to give you one example, that is a religious celebration, the Festival of Lights. And it has to do when the temple had been destroyed by invaders. And in Judas Maccabeus and others, they recovered the temple, and there was only enough oil for the lamp to be lit for maybe a matter of a few hours, but it remained miraculously lit in the center of the temple for 7 days or eight. Was it 7 days or 8 days? And so it was a miracle that this oil lasted that long until they could get more. Now that major feast day in the Jewish world is nowhere mentioned in the Old Testament except for in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. So there's an example of where something that is really integral to Judaism, both of the type of the temple Judaism at the time of Christ and the Judaism of the synagogue as it's practiced today, it's a very important feast day, and it's not in the other books of the Old Testament, it's in that particular book. So let's leave it at that. And did you say you had a second question? If so, what was that one, Miranda?
Well, my son's going to be 12 in September, and I don't think he knows how babies are made. And I think I heard in the past on your show, you recommended a good book that would kind of give them stage-by-stage revelations so as not to scandal them. Do you remember the name of that book?
Well, I don't think it was a book, at least not on this program. It might have been on Drew's show or one of the other programs where somebody discussed that. But I think what you might be thinking of, if you heard it here, wasn't a book. It was my personal way of having that talk with my sons and how I did it in stages. So I had two talks. The first talk was sort of a general talk about just, you know, isn't it great? You're growing up and you're becoming a man, and pretty soon you're going to be shaving, and kind of just give a big picture look and kind of a pep talk. This is great. This is something to look forward to. And you're going to start noticing all kinds of interesting changes in your body. And this is good. Don't be afraid of it. Don't be bothered by it. Now, I'm not going to give the talk right now because I don't know who's listening. But that whole first talk, and typically we would go on a father-son walk, my son and I. And, you know, do you have any questions? And I would try to engage him in conversation. And it was really good. And then after a little time went by, maybe a week or so, we'd go on another walk. And that's when I would say, hey, remember we were talking the other day? Yeah, I remember that. Do you have any questions about that? Well, no, or yes, or whatever. And then I would say, well, you know, I was thinking about that. And there's actually some more stuff that you probably are ready to know about. And now that you know about the big picture and you know about like your body changing and you're becoming a man and all these wonderful things, now there's some more stuff I want to tell you about. And then I would be much more specific. But the reason I did it this way, Miranda, is because I still feel that having this message delivered in stages, two stages in this case, is more, they can assimilate it better and more naturally than if it's just sort of dropped on them out of the blue. Now, when I was raising my sons, there was no internet, so they didn't have any way of knowing about some of the things that I was going to talk about other than from me or from their friends. But they had no access to things like pornography. There was no way for them to see that. Now there is, because the internet is everywhere. So maybe all the more reason why, if you're going to, you and your husband are going to do this. And in our house, my wife always had the talk with our daughters, and I wasn't there for that. And I had the talk with my sons, and my wife was not there for that. And it was always one-on-one. It was never like in a group. And truth be told, I'll leave you with this thought, Miranda. You know what made my way of doing this so specific and intentional was, you know, I love my father, and I admire him in so many ways. But when he had the talk with me, it wasn't even really a talk. It was very abrupt. I could tell he was really nervous. And we were sitting down in the, and parents, turn the radio off or down for 60 seconds. If this is not a topic that's appropriate for your younger children, if you don't think this is something that they need to hear, then just turn it down for 60 seconds. That's all I ask. Fair warning. Cyrus,
ready,
go
steady,
for
go.
It. Fair warning. All right. So my dad asked me to sit down and talk with him in the garage, and he was working at the workbench, and so it was just the two of us, and we sat down, and he's sitting there working on whatever, and I'm sitting there next to him. I don't even know, like, am I in trouble or what's going on? And he just, in a very nervous and awkward way, he said, "What do you know about sex?" And I was like, you know, I was frozen, deer in the headlights. I was embarrassed. I was, I had no words. I was really uncomfortable, and all the more so because I could tell my dad was really uncomfortable. And that was about it. And I just sort of fumbled and stumbled. I didn't really know what to say. And I think he kind of fumbled and stumbled. And so he said something like, "Well, if you ever have any questions, just let me know." And that was it. That was the whole thing. But I have to admit, I mean, for all my father's wonderful characteristics as a man, as a father, as a husband, and he's got many of them, believe me, the fact that he was nervous and that this was sort of dropped on me so abruptly gave me the impression that there was something wrong with it, something bad about this. And that's not a good attitude for a young man to have, because it's not bad. There's nothing wrong with it. God made this. God designed this for us, for our human happiness and flourishing. It has to be properly understood. It has to be properly lived out. So I don't think that the idea crossed my mind at that point when I was 11 or 12 years old that, oh, when I grow up, I'm going to do it differently. But boy, oh boy, when I did grow up and I did start having sons and they did start getting to that age range, I remembered that very vividly. And I was clear in my mind, I'm not going to do it that way. I'm going to do it a different way. And so that's where I came up with this, doing it in two stages, taking a walk. This is a pep talk. This is great. You're going to love growing up. Becoming a man is wonderful. And so I tried to approach it that way. So for what it's worth, probably more of an answer than you bargained for, Miranda, but there it is. Thank you. We're going to take a break and we'll come back with more. Keep in mind that the Supreme Court of the United States is this close. To start giving announcements. You can play it, Cyrus. Go ahead. Don't be shy. It's this close to starting handing down some decisions, including very possibly the Dobbs decision, which could strike down Roe versus Wade. I'll tell you more about that when we come back.
I've got this feeling today.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
I've got this feeling.
It relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
We are back. This is a regular program. You can call 888-914-9149 and be on the air. Love to talk to you. Let's go to Shella right now in Reno. Good morning, Shella.
Good morning, Patrick.
Hi.
It's a great day today.
Indeed it is. Well, welcome.
I want to, I called, I sent it over to relevant.com and sent you a message. Don't ignore that message. You don't have to reply to it. And you don't have to read it on there because I got you on the phone this morning. And I'm so glad that I got you on the phone because I want God to bless you in a very, very, very special way.
Thank you.
This is coming from my heart. My heart is not heavy anymore. I hope you remember me. I'm the one that had a little brother that was not a good little brother.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me, at this time, it didn't take me quite 2 years because my sister explained to me something that my brother did for me that made me feel like, you know, I need to forgive him. So I prayed, I got in there, I got in front of my crucifix, like you said, and I prayed to dear God and asked God to give me all the courage to forgive my brother, and I forgave my brother.
Oh.
And this happened day before yesterday at 5:30 p.m., that's Pacific Standard Time, and I want to thank you for talking to me on the, to put me on the phone, on the radio. But, you know, it just from the bottom of my heart, I really want to thank you for being a good person, and God is working, will be working miracles with you. I believe
Shella,
he
thank
is
you.
Because you were the one, you were my first one that I spoke to about this. I didn't even talk to my priest because I wasn't going to church at all. I didn't talk to my priest till about 3 weeks ago. And now tomorrow I'm not going to have a heavy heart and I can go do my confession and go to my church and actually partake of the communion on Sunday.
That
Maybe.
Is so
I'll
wonderful.
I'll do what my priest says.
I'm sure he's going to be delighted
because
that
God,
you...
Really. Mm-hmm. And one other thing I would like to ask, it's really important. My mom's 88 years old. She's Protestant. She's not Catholic. I became Catholic in 2006. But my mom, she's Protestant. She's not right now. She is actually professing her faith with God right now. But they took her off of medication. Her medications to transition her for passing.
Yeah.
And keep her, please keep her in your prayers, because I know God works miracles for you.
We will indeed.
Okay.
I promise you that. And I'm happy for you. I just want to say I'm happy for you. First of all, thank you for being so kind to call and share this good news with me. I really appreciate that. I have a feeling your parish priest is going to be thrilled for you that you have been able to put down this burden, give it to the Lord, and now move forward. I don't want to put any words into your mouth, Sheila, but how would you describe your change of mood or feeling or emotions once you were able to put down that burden and forgive your brother? What change do you experience in that regard?
It was a crying episode. Believe it or not, it was a crying episode. And then it was a burden that was lifted from my heart that made my heart feel happy again.
That's beautiful.
My smile's going to come back because my smile went away for a long time. Well, mm-hmm. since my brother passed. No, before my brother passed.
Mm-hmm.
And it lifts a real big load from to say that God's working miracles in my life as well.
Indeed he is. I can hear it in your voice. Well, thank you again,
thank
Shella.
You.
Thank you. Happy for you. God bless you. Wow. You know what Jesus said? Come to me, you who are heavily burdened, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. You know, if you're heavily burdened like Shella has been with these feelings of unforgiveness, hard-heartedness, who knows how she would describe it, toward her brother, Jesus says, bring it to me. I'll take it and I will lighten your load. And that's what happens. I know I sound like I'm getting choked up. I'm really not. I just have something in my throat for some reason. But it's a beautiful thing when it happens, and we can all rejoice. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Will in Bergen County, New Jersey. Hi, Will.
Hi, Patrick. I have to say ditto to you about from the woman from Reno as well.
Mm-hmm.
Listen,
thank you.
I was just wondering if you could answer some kind of trivia, but it's kind of important because I do teach religion, and that is this. Here's what confuses me, and maybe you can solve this for me. I go to Christmas Vigil Mass, and usually we do the Matthew reading, chapter 1, 1 through 25, about the generation for the genealogy of Christ. And I got to be honest with you, I'm no accountant. The IRS would never hire me. But when I read this selection from Matthew, all I get is 41 generation. And I've done it from top to bottom, reverse, and all the rest of it. And I was just wondering if you have come across that mathematical problem as well. And then staying with math, can you explain to me or solve this riddle for me? We go from the eighth Sunday in ordinary time, I'm just using this year, February 27th, and of course, then we break into the Lenten season. Mm-hmm. And then on June 26th, we pick up with the 13th Sunday in ordinary time. Can you just explain to me what happens for weeks 9 through 12? In essence, does Pentecost Sunday become part of the ordinary Sundays ordinary time?
Ordinary time.
Thank you.
Okay. That last question, probably I'm not going to be able to help you with. One thing I can tell you is that the term ordinary time does not refer to like being ordinary or extraordinary. It has to do with the way the weeks are counted. So first, second, third. So it's using ordinal numbers. First, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth. That's what the word ordinary refers to. It's not a description of the quality or anything like that of those days. But I just, that's not information that I have at my fingertips. And I wouldn't want to try to wing it, Will, and give you an answer that, you know, may or may not be true. So I'll have to take a pass on that second one. I apologize. If you're interested in that, you know who can tell you? I'm almost certain would be your parish priest, because that's the world he lives in. And in the church's calendar of readings and the feast days and all of that, I mean, he's deeply involved in that. Certainly just saying the breviary every day. He's got his finger on that pulse. So I would defer to him if you want to ask that question. Now, as for the genealogy, there are a few things I can tell you about that. Number one is that there is this apparent discrepancy between St. Matthew's genealogy and St. Luke's genealogy. Now, the number of generations that goes of... So let me just read to you a section that's from the Catholic Encyclopedia that talks about this. So the genealogy in Luke chapter 3, verses 23 through 38, ascends from Joseph to Adam, or rather to God. This is the first striking difference between the genealogies as presented in the first and third gospel. Another difference is found in their collocation. St. Matthew places his list at the beginning. St. Luke places his at the beginning of the public life of Christ. Then it goes through and it gives the names. So it starts with Jesus, Joseph, Heli, Mathat, Levi, Melchi, etc. It says, the artificial structure of this list may be inferred from the following peculiarities. It contains 11 septenaries of names. 3 septenaries bring us from Jesus to the captivity. 3 from the captivity of the time of David. 2 from David to Abraham. 3 again from the time of Abraham to the creation of man. St. Luke does not explicitly draw attention to the artificial construction of his list, but this silence does not prove that its recurring number of names was not intended. I'm just going to skip over a few points that do not necessarily pertain to this question. The fourth series of St. Luke's list covers the period between Abraham and the creation of man. St. Matthew does not touch upon this time, so that there can be no question of any harmony. the third series of St. Luke agrees name for name with the first of St. Matthew, only the order of the names is inverted. In this section, the genealogies are rather identical rather than merely harmonious. In the first and second series, St. Luke gives David's descendants through his son Nathan, while Matthew enumerates his second and third series, David's descendants through Solomon. It is true that the first gospel gives only 28 names for this period against the 42 names of the third gospel, but it cannot be expected that two different lines of descendants should exhibit the same number of links for the period of 1,000 years. Abstracting from the inspired character of the sources, one is disposed to regard the number given by the third evangelist, Luke, as more in harmony with the length of time than the number of the first gospel, Matthew. But we have pointed out that St. Matthew consciously omitted a number of names in his genealogical list in order to reduce them to the required multiple of 7. So that's what he means when it talks about the, where's that word again? The, I just had it here. The word that has to do with groups of 7. So that is, I think, the answer to your question. It goes into another section after that where it talks about the difficulties that are found between the two, how they can be harmonized in general, why these numbers were chosen, why did he leave out certain names in the case of Matthew, etc. So I can share this link with you if you're interested. I have a feeling it's going to get even deeper into the technical details than maybe you want to go, but that's what I have to offer you, Will. Is that helpful?
So I can go back and really digest what you were actually explaining.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot there. And it's, as you can see, there is quite a bit of technical data. This is an issue. Some call it a problem, but it's an issue that scholars have worked on since the time of the church fathers, because at first glance, there seems to be a discrepancy here. But okay. I think, so you see where they're talking here about how these two genealogies are actually harmonious, even though different names and different numbers of names are given. But that would take too long to try to drill down on the air. But at least if you go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, you'll find the link, and then you can just go straight there. It's hosted by the Catholic Encyclopedia Online. It's hosted at Catholic Answers. Website, Catholic.com.
Okay. Patrick, I really appreciate it. Thanks for taking
You're me. Welcome.
You know what it is? When you teach religion, kids will come up with these questions, and I don't want to be stumped by it when I myself am perplexed by this as well. So I
Understandable.
Really appreciate you.
You're welcome.
My eyes here.
Hey, Will, let me just, before you go, let me give you one suggestion. You're going to really like a book by Father William Most, M-O-S-T. It's called Catholic Apologetics Today, and he has a chapter on this very issue, the genealogies of Luke and Matthew. And he was a scripture scholar. He taught scripture at Loras College in Dubuque, Iowa, and he knows his stuff. He's dead now, but he knows his stuff. And that and many other similar kinds of objections that are scriptural in nature, he covers in that book. So if you want to be even more prepared for some of the questions that your kids might throw at you, that book, Catholic Apologetics Today, will be helpful. Thank you. I appreciate that. Let's see. 888-914-9149 is the number to call if you want to be on the air. I have a note here that comes in from Catherine, and she's listening in Chicago on 950 AM. She says, is it possible for generational graces to exist just like generational sin? If I have special graces received through my sacraments, can I pass that along to my child? Specifically, if my child is lost due to miscarriage, does my baptism or any other sacrament I may have received transfer to my unborn child, since we share my body during pregnancy? I'm not satisfied with the answer we Catholics have, that we don't know what happens with miscarried babies or those who pass before baptism. Thank you. Well, that's a great question. I'll put it this way. When you think about the nature of baptism, you realize that baptism is like the foundation for all the other sacraments. Baptism is the sacrament that activates, if we can use that terminology, it kind of spiritually activates your soul. Because we're all conceived in the condition of original sin, Kathy, our souls are spiritually inert. It's like a brand new car parked in your driveway. If it's just sitting there doing nothing, that's nice. It It's a nice looking car, but it can't do what cars are made to do until you get in the car and turn it on. Then when you turn it on and the engine is running, then the car can fulfill its carness. It can do what cars are made to do, which is get out on the open road. In an analogous kind of way, the soul is like that. It's like just sitting there and it can't do what it was intended by God to do, which is to be happy with him forever in heaven. That requires activating the soul because Adam and Eve lost this original grace that they had in the fall, so they couldn't hand it down to us. So in baptism, the soul is regenerated. The soul is reborn. The soul is animated with life, the supernatural life of God. All sin and the condition of original sin and all the effects of sin are all eradicated. So the soul is now brimming with divine life. We call that grace. Then the soul is able to do all the other things that the other sacraments help it to do. So the reason I'm going into this background is because it's the answer to your question about a child who might be lost through miscarriage. Your baptism does that to you. It doesn't pass down to your children, either in utero or after the fact. And because the child has not been baptized, it does not have the capability of receiving any other sacrament. So confirmation or any of the other sacraments that you might have received, they're for you, and they need baptism in order to be effective. But because this doesn't pass down to the child who's in your body, it doesn't have that effect on the child. So the church says that we have every reason to believe in God's grace and mercy and to trust and hope and pray that these children will be given sanctifying grace in a way different from what Jesus requires from us in this life. I hope that's helpful. Very interesting question. I'll be right back.